So today my topic is the socialist business cycle. And this is something that I think a lot of people would think was sort of a contradiction in terms, something that logically couldn't exist at all. After all, why would the central planner plan a series of investment booms and busts? We might think that central planning is inefficient, so we might think, well, under socialism, growth will be anemic. But it might be a little harder to see why growth should also be cyclical. So what I want to do today is first talk about very briefly the experience of actual existing socialist countries by way of dispelling the myth that booms and busts don't occur in real existing socialist countries. And then I want to, my real point is to look at this from a theoretical point of view. Is it possible, in theory at least, that there could be some kind of stabilizing role for central planning, as socialists claim? And I'm going to find that no, even in theory, even under in the ideal socialist commonwealth, you're still going to have investment booms and busts. And then finally, I want to show how we can generalize Austrian business cycle theory to include this socialist boom-bust phenomenon. So first of all, the record of booms and busts in real existing socialist countries. Here's some data from Cornai's 1992 book called The Socialist System. And Cornai looked at investment growth in a sample of socialist and non-socialist countries for the period from 1960 to 1989. He looked at the coefficient of variation of these time series. The coefficient of variation, of course, is just the standard deviation divided by the mean. So the higher this measure is, the more volatile the underlying time series. And of course, the interesting thing you see here is that out of the top five most volatile economies for this time period in the sample, four were Eastern European socialist countries. We got Yugoslavia, Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. So as Cornai points out, it's not only is it not the case empirically that socialist countries are not plagued by investment booms and busts, but actually, in fact, in a lot of cases, the socialist boom-bust cycle has been more extreme than what's observed in non-socialist countries. And a great example of a country with a socialist country with extreme boom-bust cycle is the case of China, where the boom-bust cycle really goes all the way back to the Great Leap Forward, which you see all the way over on the left in 1958. I show in my book that the Chinese investment cycle today is really just a continuation of this Maoist era cycle, this pre-1978 cycle, that a lot of the drivers are still really the same, which means that this socialist boom-bust cycle, it's not just a historical curiosity. It's not just something that is of merely academic interest. It's something that's actually a big driver of cycles in the global economy today. Well, the apologist for socialism might still like to claim, well, these boom-bust cycles in the real existing socialist economies, these are just unfortunate consequences of the way that those societies were organized, their institutional arrangements. Now, if we could probably perfect these systems somehow, then maybe there still would be a stabilizing role for central planning. So my real objective here is to show that no, that's not the case either, that not only empirically has there never been any stabilizing role for central planning, but even in theory, even under ideal conditions, we would still have boom and bust cycles under central planning. So my contention that there will be booms in the... Oh, sorry. Sorry about that. My contention that there will still be booms in the socialist commonwealth is based on these three main assumptions. First, that the central planner's priority is going to be economic growth. This is something that's pretty much always been the case historically. Second, and this is the key one, that local knowledge is going to be economically significant regardless of how the economy is organized. And this is something that Marx and Engels and Lenin explicitly rejected. They believed that technological progress would make local knowledge obsolete. They believed that factory automation and standardization would mean that it was no longer necessary to consider local knowledge. That local, there wouldn't really be any such thing as economically significant local knowledge. This seems naive to us today, but this really is what is the basic assumption, for example, behind Marx's contention that there would no longer be any need for the standardization of labor. Now, my third assumption has to do with a person whom I refer to as the cadre on the spot. The cadre on the spot, of course, is the socialist analog of Hayek's famous man on the spot. He's the local level investment decision maker. In the socialist commonwealth, he's going to be a state-owned enterprise manager or an official in a local government. Notice that my second assumption makes it necessary for there to be such a person, because there's going to have to be someone at the local level to figure out how the plan, the details of how the central plan is going to be operated in the case where local knowledge is economically significant. Well, this is an ideal socialist commonwealth. So my cadre on the spot is a model cadre. He's concerned only with plan fulfillment. He's very different from a real cadre. Real cadre's concern is career advancement and, when possible, self-enrichment through corruption. So this is the ideal cadre. This is where I'm putting in the assumption that this problem of a socialist boom is not something that can be fixed through some kind of change in cadre's incentive structures. This is the ideal cadre. He doesn't need any better incentives. He's focused on plan fulfillment. So how do these three give us a boom? Well, first of all, central planning by definition has got to occur in the absence of local knowledge. And that means that the planner is going to be unaware of many of the alternative employments in which the resources required for his economic growth plan would otherwise be employed. And so being unaware of the opportunity costs of his growth target, he's going to set the growth target too high. And then at the cadre on the spot level, what's going to happen is that the cadre does have local knowledge, is aware of alternative employments in which resources could be employed, but since his only objective is plan fulfillment, and he sees that these alternative activities are not included in the plan, he's going to assign the opportunity cost to the resources that those alternative activities would require. He's going to assign those resources an effectively opportunity cost of zero, because those alternative activities, he knows what they are, but they're not in the plan. So the opportunity cost of diverting resources from those employments into plan fulfillment for him is perceived to be zero. So we get excess investment, we get malinvestment, we get diversion of resources into more roundabout production, in exactly the same way that happens when the man on the spot is confronted with a sub-equilibrium rate of interest. Well, this socialist boom is going to be followed by a bust if we add these two additional assumptions. First of all, that the macro effects of malinvestment by the local level investment decision maker eventually become general knowledge as opposed to only local knowledge. And you can easily see how this will happen from an example like the Great Leap Forward. During the Great Leap Forward, the local cadres transferred labor from agriculture into industry. And Of course, the result was a precipitous decline in grain output, and that is something that does show up in nationwide economic statistics that the planner is aware of. Well, and the second assumption is that the macro effects of malinvestment will threaten longer-term economic growth. So how do we get a bust? Well, the planner is going, these imbalances that have resulted from unsustainably high growth targets become visible to the planner at the point at which the effects become visible in the macroeconomic statistics. And the planner will be able then to perceive that there's a threat to his long-term growth objective, and it ultimately will have no alternative except to impose some kind of an austerity program. And notice that the austerity program will have to involve the same types of irrationality as the boom that preceded it, because the central planner also lacks the local knowledge he would need to decide which projects to halt, which projects to suspend. Instead, the projects are going to have to be halted on the basis of ad hoc criteria, such as which sector the project is in, or maybe the location of the project, or the size of the project, things like that. So we have a boom-bust socialist cycle, even in the most ideal of socialist commonwealths. Well, how do we fit that into, how do we extend Austrian business cycle theory to include this socialist boom-bust cycle? Well, of course, we're used to learning about Austrian business cycle in terms of the institutions of the free market economy. So we're used to thinking about an expansion of the money supply in the banking sector leading to a fall in interest rates, followed by malinvestment, which eventually results in inflation, and then interest rates go up and the cycle comes to an end. But we don't have to tell the story in terms of free market institutions. We can tell a much more general story that's still exactly the same story, but applies equally well to the socialist commonwealth. It's a general story about an initial expansionary impulse leading to a distortion in some signal of society's rate of time preference. And I think that what's really the distinctively Austrian feature of Austrian business cycle theory is this idea of distortion in signaling of society's rate of time preference. And that distorted signal produces a response on the part of investment decision makers, which then entails a macro effect followed by an adjustment. This is really what the story is in its very broadest outlines, and it perfectly fits the socialist case as well, where instead of the impulse, the expansionary impulse coming from the banking sector, it's coming from a central planner, and the distortion, the rate of time preference signal takes the form of a high growth target instead of a lower interest rate, but it's the same, ultimately the same problem. Either way, you've got malinvestment. Whether you have physical shortages or inflation is just really a matter of whether the price system is allowed to operate. Either way, an adjustment is inevitable at some point because the initial malinvestment is ultimately unsustainable, whether it takes the form of administratively applied austerity or interest rate increases, you still are going to have the same type of investment bust at the end of the cycle. So finally, one last point I want to make is that the socialist era cycle, I think, is also a great example of what Husmann referred to in his 1998 paper as an era cycle. And Husmann describes the era cycle as recurring erroneous behavior on the part of many, many persons that's the result of some form of government intervention. And where better to look for recurring erroneous behavior as a result of government intervention than in the socialist commonwealth, where presumably every form of economic activity is the result of some form of government intervention. So that's all the time I have, so I'll I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.